Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit our website anytime you like. It's rte.ie/Mooney. Today, we hear about an online course for beginners run by the Dublin Beekeepers Association.
Oh, what a glorious thing to be, a healthy grown-up busy, busy bee, filing away the passing hours, pinching all the pollen from the cauliflowers.
In the second of her reports on how our family are faring in this year's annual Garden Bird Survey, Jenny Brannigan enlists the help of ornithologist Eric Dempsey.
I'm known as the board man in the schools, like board, B-U-R-D, that's in Dublin, the board man.
And 12-year-old Quiva from County Clare tells us the extraordinary story of when she came home to discover a fox sleeping in her bed.
I was very frightened. Like, I kind of jumped back and ran out the door, and I got Mummy and Granddad and told them, and I was confused myself, didn't know what I just saw, I didn't know whether it was a teddy or whether it was a real fox.
Oh, it really is a lovely story, and I can't wait to bring it to you a little bit later on. And also, if you're interested in becoming a beekeeper, listen out for Kieran Harnett, Public Relations Officer with the Dublin Beekeepers Association. Actually, when I spoke to him earlier, there was a lot of sounds coming from his back garden, but not the type you'd expect from a garden full of beehives.
I'm standing in my greenhouse at the back of my house in my garden, which is about 25 feet away from the beehives, and I've got about a dozen chickens in here with me because they like the heat. They come in the wintertime. It's a shame it's the wintertime because I could go and stand beside the hives in the springtime and you'd hear the buzz in the air.
Oh, I just love making this programme because you meet all sorts of people and you hear the most extraordinary sounds. Anyway, let's get on with it and meet our panel today, starting in County Clare with Aine Launa. Aine.
Yes, indeed, I am here down in County Clare, where I don't know if it's warmer than Dublin, but I'm noticing signs of spring on my walk now. There's lots of lovely heart-shaped leaves, which are the leaves of the lesser celandine, and I have seen some of the celandine flowers as well, little buttercup-type things, and it's a great, it really gladdens your heart to see them. There's lots of ferns too, interestingly. I saw four ferns all together on a bank yesterday, the hard fern, the heart's tongue fern, the male fern, and the polypodium fern, which is the one that has polypodium, many feet, and it tells you what it actually looks like with its little side branches and little circular sori on the backs of the leaves. So to see all these plants coming up inexorably, in spite of it being still January, it would gladden your heart. It would, Derek.
Spring has sprung, it sounds like, which is the perfect cue to go to the National Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin, where we can say hello to Matthew Jebb. Matthew.
Hello, Derek. And yes, the Botanic Gardens, likewise, many signs of spring here. The daffodil leaves are pushing up. And as Aine says, the little lesser celandines, we've got the first blooms open now. And we've got winter aconite still in full bloom now. So, you know, these little yellow flowers sprinkled on the lawns give a real thrill to the coming year.
Richard, anything like that out in Malahide?
Yes, Derek. I think the Brent geese are getting a little restless because they're going to have to make this enormous journey right across the Atlantic, right up to Bathurst Island in the Canadian Arctic. Now, they're very agitated right now. They fly over the house quite a bit, back and forth several times each day. Maybe it's because there's so many people walking around and so many dogs that they're being disturbed. But I suspect that the call of the wild is really behind their movements.
Well, the Brent goose is really the goose you're going to see wild flying around Dublin, is it not? If you go to Wexford, you're going to see the Greenland white-fronted goose, half the world's population there, but it's the Brent goose in Dublin.
It is indeed. The Brent should be Dublin's county goose. And if you go to America, you find every state has its state bird. Well, Dublin's state bird should be, I think, the Brent goose. Just as the state plant should be the Buddleia, it's everywhere. And the goose is more or less everywhere where there's open space.
Mind you, there are Brent geese down here in Clare too. Not hundreds and hundreds, but they have a recognised route just here south of Kilrush and Powlishéirí Bay. And there are great northern divers here as well, which is a real thrill to see those as well. So we're not short in the bird department here either, Richard.
Richard, you wrote an article in the Irish Examiner some time ago about Brent geese, and if you don't mind me paraphrasing you, you said that they preferred short grass like playing fields and parklands because the food source was available to them all the time, whereas if they were looking for their natural food source of the green algae and the like, it was very much dependent on the tide when they could feed, and that they liked short cropped grass because they'd short bills. I wonder, would you welcome them into the Botanic Gardens, Matthew? I'm not sure what area of grassland you have there, but you've plenty of it.
Well, geese actually make a very nice lawn. When you get geese browsing on lawns, it is amazing what a fine sort of turf you develop, a very fine leaves.
You're here today, Matthew, to talk about the Venus flytrap, the latest research. Venus flytraps, ladies and gentlemen of the listening public, have memories, apparently.
Well, this is some extraordinary research that's just been done, Derek, on understanding how the Venus flytrap works. Now, some of your listeners probably have grown the Venus flytrap. It is one of the most miraculous plants on this planet because it's able to catch flies with these little snap-shutting leaves. The leaves act like little gin traps, if you like. They can actually catch a fly and digest it. And that is what the plant then derives all its nitrogen from. So these plants in the wild grow in very nutrient-poor, sandy soils in North America, in the North Carolinas. And the first settlers there, when they saw this plant, they were astonished. And it was sent back to no greater man than Carl Linnaeus in the middle of the 18th century. And he just did not believe this idea that a plant would be eating an insect, because this went against the nature of things. But in fact, it was well proven by people like Charles Darwin later on that this is exactly what these plants are doing. They are carnivorous. They're able to catch a fly and eat it. Now, when they saw these little leaves able to snap shut in a time length of about 1/10 of a second. Now, a human reaction time is about 1/3 of a second. So, you know, we're quite slow at being able to do things or react to things. This plant, which has no muscles and no nerves, is able to perform one of the fastest movements in the plant world. And for many centuries, although it's been known how it works, nobody has been able to explain exactly what the mechanism is. Now, this recent research in Japan is extraordinary because it's able to visualize exactly how the Venus flytrap has actually got a short-term memory. Now, what Darwin and other researchers discovered is there are three little hairs on the inside of these traps. And if you touch one of the hairs, the trap is not triggered. Because if something was to brush one hair and then move out of the trap, it would be wasting its time snapping shut with nothing inside. In fact, what you have to do is touch at least two of the hairs within 30 seconds. So this is like an insect has landed and it's walking around the leaves. So by the time a second hair is triggered, the plant is able to know, if you like, that there is a prey item there. It's worth snapping shut. Because, of course, snapping shut without a fly in it is a waste of a lot of energy, because the only way these traps can reopen is they have to grow. They have to grow a little bit bigger, and that uses up a lot of energy and nutrition. So people knew that this plant somehow had a memory. And what was it? The way that the researchers have been able to actually visualize this, so it's not a matter of statistics, but you can actually see the way the Venus flytrap remembers that one of its hairs has been touched, is that they have genetically engineered some Venus flytrap cells, and what they have put in is an extraordinary protein from a species of jellyfish. And this protein, when you shine ultraviolet light on it, it glows bright green. It's a process called fluorescence. So under ultraviolet light, you can see that when you touch one of these hairs, there is a huge flood of calcium ions coming out of the cells. So they've put the little protein from the jellyfish into the cells, into the DNA of the Venus flytrap, and it enables that plant to actually fluoresce every time calcium levels get high outside the cells. So the way the plant is signaling to the whole leaf that I've just been touched over here on this hair is it causes a cascade of calcium ions to be released by the cells. And by putting in this fluorescent protein with a calcium receptor on it, it means that every time the calcium levels go up, the plant starts to glow bright green. And this is happening very fast. It's a process of about 2 centimetres in a second. It doesn't sound quick, but the trap is only about 2 centimetres long. So in 1 second, the entire trap knows one of the hairs has been touched. Now, if within 30 seconds, a second hair is touched, this means a second huge flood of calcium ions is released. And if it's done within those 30 seconds, it passes a threshold, a sort of level of calcium, which means the entire leaf now changes shape. Because once this threshold is passed, the cells, literally the calcium comes out of them first. This is followed by an osmotic change, which is water moves out of the cells and into the cell walls, and therefore it deflates slightly. Now, the mechanism by which this trap snaps shut, it's not got a muscle, but it's a bit like a tennis ball, a broken tennis ball. Now, some of the listeners may know that when a tennis ball is broken, you can sort of turn the whole thing inside out. You can sort of twist the rubber so that the tennis ball is inside out. And if you leave it there for a second or two, it snaps back to its original shape. And that is what the Venus flytrap does. That tiny change in the pressure of the cells causes the trap to literally buckle in shape and snap closed. So this was a remarkable ability of ultra-fast photography to visualize that. But now we can see with this experiment with the fluorescent protein, we can see how it is that the trigger hairs are able essentially to talk to one another and to remember, the leaf can remember that it was touched within 30 seconds. And this is an ingenious trick that the plant has evolved that enables it to only snapshot when it's pretty sure there's a prey item walking about, touching hairs one after another. So as long as that second trigger hair is touched within a few seconds of the first one, the leaf remembers throughout its surface, I've already been touched once, so I know I've been touched a second time. I can snapshot and I'm pretty sure I'm going to catch a fly, which is then digested. And the plant, with all of that huge supply of minerals and nutrients, is able to then happily grow new leaves, set flowers, and so on. So this is perhaps the first time that we've got a mechanism of how a plant has got a memory, a 30-second memory, even though it has no brain or nerves in its body.
This is amazing stuff, Matthew. In animal cells, it's potassium and sodium ions that cross the cell membrane and make nerves work. But you're saying there's no nerves at all like that in this plant or in any plant. And that's what's happening is a physical thing in a sense, caused by the calcium ions making the cells less and more. So the whole thing just snaps shut. Physically, like a tennis ball. You couldn't accuse a tennis ball of having any nerves. When you said about Linnaeus thinking this was against the order of things, and Linnaeus was from Sweden, and obviously these fly plants didn't occur in Europe, but surely Linnaeus in Sweden must have known about sundew plants. He must have known about the bog plants that eat insects. I mean, why did he think, you know, this was against the law of God nearly for plants to be eating animals? Would he not have been aware of these other plants in Europe to do this?
He was. And what is amazing is, although, you know, we sort of take it for granted that a sundew is a carnivorous plant, it wasn't until Darwin did all his experiments to prove it. Prior to that, people thought it was just sticky and it was rather inconvenient. The insect would get trapped and sometimes it would die on the plant. But nobody had the grasp like Darwin did that everything in nature had an explanation, that there was, through natural selection, this amazing view of the world biologically, that everything had a purpose behind it. So once Darwin had seen how these plants were devouring insects, today we know of pitcher plants and the Venus flytrap and sundews and butterworts, all trapping prey items. But to Linnaeus, he was unaware, I suppose, of the digestion taking place, the transfer of minerals. And it takes a lot of experimentation. And really, Linnaeus was an observational scientist more than a person who experimented.
Linnaeus came up with that idea, I believe, because the Venus flytrap releases insects that are too small, so that they creep out. It will only digest large insects capable of giving it enough nutrient. Now, Linnaeus declared that they always release their prisoners, the Venus flytraps. And he thought that the larger insects were in the flytrap sheltering from frogs. This thing of releasing the baby ones or the small ones inspired another commentator, a fellow called Cesare Lombroso. Lombroso, who was the father of criminality. He, in fact, invented the term criminality. Now, he thought that this plant was the source of criminality. He thought that criminal tendencies were inherited, an idea that we do not accept anymore. But he thought that this tendency began with the Venus flytrap. And he thought the plant could premeditate because he noticed that the little insects escaped. He thought the plant decided to release the small insects. So it had discrimination. It had the freedom to decide whether to eat something or not. And of course, it ambushed things, so it premeditated. So he ascribed to this plant the whole source of criminality in us and everything else.
Well, I suppose the interesting aspect of the way the Venus flytrap works is it is able to distinguish between something that's not worth catching and something that is worth catching, because the reaction time of a fly is much, much faster than a human being. I think within a tenth of a second, a fly can react, whereas us poor humans, we're always unable to quite swat the fly because the fly is able to move faster than our eye and muscles. But the plant, of course, in order to catch that fly, has got to make sure that A, it's going to do that snapping shut as quickly as possible when it knows there's something triggering it. And also this very ingenious way that the three little trigger hairs make sure that the insect moving around is large enough to not only knock the hair, but also is dawdling around. It's probably feeding and it's pushing its proboscis around and it knocks into the other hairs. Because another interesting observation is if you touch one hair, but you keep on pushing that hair for maybe a whole second, you slowly push that hair, it's the equivalent really of a snail or a slug moving against the hair. And that causes the same reaction, because it causes multiple waves of calcium being released by these cells, so that, again, it goes past the threshold and it snaps shut. Because a slug or a snail is just as tasty a meal as a fly. And one of the interesting things, and Aina, you were pointing out how it's very similar to the nerves of animals which use calcium and sodium ions. The plant way of sort of talking to other plant cells with calcium, it's very similar. It's equivalent to a Mexican wave. If you think of a Mexican wave running around a big football stadium, nobody's actually moved. Everybody has been in their same place. They've hopped up and down and sat back in their seat. And it gives you a visual representation of something moving, but nothing has actually moved. And that is how these plants are able to literally tell the next door cell, release your calcium. And this sort of wave of calcium release is propagated across plant tissue. Normally, other plants do the same thing. You know, people know about these calcium fluxes in plants, and it seems to be very important in defending a plant against fungal infection. So a fungus attacks a plant and this results in changes in surrounding cells. So they can develop tannins and chemical defenses against being attacked by the fungus. But here in the Venus flytrap, the speed is much, much faster than in any other plant. And this wonderful experiment enables you to actually, you know, view a little film clip of the calcium causing this bright green fluorescence. So it's a very pleasing discovery in that by an ingenious experiment, you can actually show what the plant is doing.
Is there any danger that the plant is actually tasting its food and just doesn't like the taste of one sort of insect and likes the taste of another?
That is exactly the sort of experiment that Charles Darwin and his son Francis would have delighted in. They would have tried out all these different things. And, you know, they used to use little cut-up pieces of egg white, boiled egg white, so it was little hard white, chunky pieces of egg white, and they would put them on sundews and into Venus flytraps and watch how they were digested. But, in fact, the Venus flytrap does not do that. It doesn't distinguish between, because some insects are going to be very hard and chunky. If you imagined a nice soft squishy spider or a hard chunky cricket with big thick exoskeleton, you know, you might say, well, I'll go for the nice soft spider, but it's not fussy. Once it's snapped shut on something, it will go on and try and digest it, whatever it is. And sometimes they do make the mistake of trapping a leaf blowing in the wind. And because it's in there, the poor old trap closes up and actually it gets nothing from that exercise. So the answer is no, they do not distinguish a nice tasty meal and they're not fussy.
By the way, before you leave us, I saw you on the Today Show with Diane Sinead during the week talking about our Iron Nature competition.
That's a very exciting project right now because, you know, I think all of us are blown away at the number of submissions pouring in. So even in the first week, we've got close to 3,000 photographs have been uploaded to the Eye on Nature portal. And, you know, it's a great opportunity for anybody who's out and about, who catches an amazing shot of wildlife, animal or plant, consider submitting it because you never know. It's going to be a thrilling final back in March when the 12 finalists are going to be exhibited here at the gardens. And we're really looking forward to something that's going to be a great attraction in these difficult times.
Well, Matthew, we'll be speaking with you in a couple of weeks' time about potential plant species that might make interesting subjects for this photographic competition for our listeners. But now let's turn our attention to the birds. Over 450 bird species have been recorded in Ireland. Everything from the very rare and elusive short-eared owl, which winters on our coastal lowlands, to the majestic, equally elusive and rare golden eagle, which was reintroduced to Donegal in 2001. But if you want to catch a glimpse of something more common, all you have to do is open that door and go outside into your garden or into your local parkland, or restrictions permitting, and if you're within 5 kilometres, head along to Birdwatch Ireland's East Coast Nature Reserve in County Wicklow. Now, you all know Niall Hatch. Niall's a regular contributor to Mooney Goes Wild, but for his day job, he is the Public Relations, Branches and Development Officer with Birdwatch Ireland. Earlier, he sent us this field report about the variety of species gathering around their feeders on the reserve right now.
Hi Derek, I'm here in Birdwatch Ireland's East Coast Nature Reserve in Newcastle in County Wicklow. It's a bit of a squelchy day here today, going through the mud. Just approaching our bird feeders here. There's a nice mix of species. Just as we're arriving, I actually saw a great spotted woodpecker fly up from the feeders. That was a real treat. I wish I had my camera with me. I might come back with it later because you can get great shots of the birds here. Just on a simple feeder like this, you don't even have to be at a nature reserve. You can do this in your own back garden. There's blue tits there, grey tits. There's a robin hopping around, a dunnock on the ground just below it. You can see them squabbling with each other and fighting over the food. All those kind of things that make a great action shot. So it's nice that I have this nature reserve here. It's within 5 kilometres of my home. I take my exercise walk here. I'm very fortunate, but even if you're not as lucky as me to have a nature reserve on the doorstep, putting up a hanging feeder in your garden, putting peanuts, sunflower seeds, something like that, you never know what you might attract in. And always be prepared. I think if you're trying to take a good picture of wildlife, carry your camera with you as much as you can when you're out walking, because you never know when that opportunity is going to present itself, when that bird or that animal or that pretty plant is going to disappear in front of you, and you'll miss the moment if you don't have the camera with you. So very often the best shots I find are spontaneous ones that aren't overly planned. You get want to get action, you want to get that sense of movement as well. And what better place than a bird feeder? Just watching it here now at the moment, there's the dunnock there on the feeder right now, hoping that woodpecker might come back in. There's a chaffinch in the tree up above. You very clearly see actually a genuine pecking order among the birds here at a feeder, the ones that are dominant over others. The grey tits are particularly bossy to the others. The blue tits know how to stick up for themselves, so they can come in too. But then you have other birds like the siskins, the goldfinches, they hang back a bit. When that woodpecker comes though, you know it, because all the other birds will immediately react or scarp or give it space. And actually, I remember last year I was at this very spot when all of a sudden a sparrowhawk flew in, grabbed one of the blue tits off the feeder, and I just wished I'd had my camera ready and waiting for that. So always be prepared. So yeah, I think I'm going to stay here just a bit longer, see what turns up, and maybe get that perfect shot. I can't enter the competition myself, unfortunately, but I hope a lot of the listeners will. Now, I'm fortunate that I'm able to visit this nature reserve here within my 5K, but you can actually replicate a scene like this in most back gardens across Ireland. It's not that difficult, really. A couple of hanging feeders, providing water for the birds, that's important. So right below the feeders here at the reserve, we have a flooded area where the birds can come down and they can drink and they can bathe. In your garden, putting out a dish of water on the ground, that can really help, especially when the temperatures drop below freezing. It's hard for the birds to find water outside of gardens, so it can be a real lifeline for them. But importantly, from a photography point of view, you can also get some really wonderful shots of the birds bathing, you know, splashing, maybe capture the droplets, you know, with a fast shutter speed, something like that. So please don't think that you have to go to some exotic location to try and get great shots of wildlife. A back garden can do the job very, very nicely.
Thank you, Niall. More details on our website and some pictures that have already been sent in for you to peruse, rte.ie/Mooney.
Look deep into nature, said Albert Einstein, and you will understand everything better. And where better to celebrate our natural world than in the art of nature photography? Calling all budding photographers and nature lovers alike. Join us for the first Eye on Nature wildlife photography competition. To enter, see rte.ie/eyeonnature. For updates, watch The Today Show on RTE One and tune in to Mooney Goes Wild on RTE Radio One. Eye on Nature, presented by RTE with the National Botanic Gardens Dublin and the Office of Public Works. RTE Eye on Nature. See the world.
Now let's turn our attention to the Irish Garden Bird Survey, Birdwatch Ireland's most popular citizen science survey. Over 1,000 gardens participating each year. Well, one garden making an appearance for the first time belongs to Jenny Brannigan. She and her family are taking part on behalf of Mooney Goes Wild. And for this, the second in a series of reports Jenny is making for us, she has enlisted the help of the very cream of Irish ornithological expertise, Mr. Eric Dempsey.
Hello, Derek, and hello to the Mooney Goes Wild team. I hope you're all staying safe and well these days. We are past the halfway mark here for the Irish Garden Bird Survey, and I'm in Ballantyre, and I'm actually sitting out in my garden here talking to you. It's a beautiful, clear evening. It's chilly, as you'd expect in January, but it's lovely to sit out and actually enjoy the fresh air.
These days, I've been feeling lucky, looking all around me. See so many dreams that have come true, like me right next to you.
Derek, the last time I was on to you, it was the first day of the survey. And just to remind your listeners, that was the 30th of November. We checked in with you again about 5 weeks later when we were talking about the birds we had spotted so far. And as you know, my whole family's involved in this. I have Jamie, who's 11, Holly is 9, and my husband, Dave. And my mother-in-law, Dolores, she is loving this too. She donated her bird bath to us since we last spoke. So we're in lockdown again, of course, and the kids are off school now. So birdwatching has become a great way to occupy us. We're tending to sit together at the table, looking out while we're having a cup of coffee or a nice hot chocolate. But we have found that sometimes we could be sitting there for ages and there's not much activity. So that got us thinking about what more we could be doing to attract other types of birds into our garden here. And I thought we might enlist the help of a professional. So who better to ask than Eric Dempsey, expert ornithologist, a regular Mooney Goes Wild contributor, as you know, and he's written lots of books on this subject. Now, Eric is based in Wicklow, and with the current restrictions, we couldn't have him visit us here in the garden to check it out in person, but we didn't let that stop us. I sent Eric on a few photos of the garden, so he was able to see where the hanging feeder is, the general layout of it, so that he can give us a little bit more advice on what else we might do to encourage more birds into the garden here. Eric, how are you?
Hello, Jenny. How are you? It's lovely to be talking to you. I saw your pictures of the garden, and it's classic sort of suburban garden. It's neat and it's tidy. It's beautiful little garden, and you have one feeder on a garden fence. But you also do have several shrubs and trees at the back of the garden. So first thing I'd always say about attracting birds into the garden is that variety is the spice of life. Birds feed on a wide variety of different foods. And if you put out different foods, you will get different birds. Now, I'm living in Wicklow and I'm outdoors here right in front of my feeders. It's all very quiet at the moment. But I put out a whole selection of different types of food. And as a result, I have an amazing variety of birds. For example, Niger seed. Now, Niger seed is very, very small black seeds. And they come with special feeders, which have very small openings for birds to feed on. But they're almost a staple diet of goldfinches. They go through bags of Niger seed. I always say that they don't even eat it. They just like suck it up. But among the goldfinches, we have birds like redpolls and siskins, which are coming into the garden. And they are also concentrating on the Niger seed. Nut feeders, of course, will attract a whole range of birds that will come onto your nut feeders. You know, you have the blue tits and the grey tits and the coal tits, as well as birds like greenfinches. I put out sunflower seeds. I even really treat the birds here in Wicklow. I put out sunflower hearts, which are the sunflower seeds outside of their shells. And coal tits adore them. They will take them away and bury them. Because Derek was talking about how birds survive in the winter in last week's show. It's been proven that the memory of a coal tit, the part of their brain that stores memory, increases in activity in winter. Because what they do is they will come to your seed feeder, they will take the seeds away and bury them, and they will remember where they are should we get cold weather. So, you know, you'll often find coal tits coming to your seed feeder and they're not even eating, they're just flying away with them. So my seed feeders are emptying all the time. I put suet balls out. Long-tailed tits adore suet balls. And I put ordinary seed down on the ground, as well as apples and things. So variety is the spice of life. That's your first thing, the first thing I would say. A bigger variety of food attracts a wider variety of birds.
Eric, it sounds like you have a fantastic array of seeds down there. We have been putting out sunflower seeds, and then we find that we're trying to increase the activity. So we throw them on the grass, we put them around the bird bath, we put them up on a couple of different surfaces, like we have a picnic table there. And then we put out as well almonds and some walnuts. And we notice then that when we throw it out onto the grass, within a couple of minutes, we get a whole load of magpies swooping down. And of course, we're trying to attract other different types of birds, but it's always the magpies that come flying down to pick up those seeds and those nuts that we throw out. So it sounds like we definitely need to go back to the pet shop and get some different type of seed.
Yeah, birds like magpies and jackdaws and rooks, they're opportunistic, and they will come in and they will see food. And I think the key is different feeders, because, you know, magpies can't swing out of a seed feeder. Now, I have found here in Wicklow that jackdaws have been able to unscrew my nut feeders. You know, there's a screw at the bottom and it loosens it up, and they're able to unscrew that. All the nuts fall on the ground and they all fly away with big cropfuls of peanuts. So jackdaws are very clever, and magpies are as well. But I think if you have a different variety of feeders, so you have Niger seed feeders, you have sunflower, you know, ordinary seed feeders, you have nut feeders and suet ball feeders, a lot of the larger birds can't land on those. So it gives the smaller birds a better opportunity to feed. And often people will put out feeders into their garden, but they will put them too close to the house straight away. So sometimes you need to bring your feeders to the back of the garden first, let the birds discover your feeders, and bring them slowly closer and closer to your kitchen window. Let the birds adjust to the fact that this is a safe garden. A lot of people I've spoken to like will have put up a load of cedars and seed feeders and nut feeders right outside the kitchen window where there's a lot of activity. Maybe you're all at home, you and your husband are at home, the kids are at home, and they don't know your garden very well. So they have to build up a trust that this is a safe place to feed, because a lot of predators swoop in, or there might be a cat around and things like that. So birds need to gain a bit of trust before they come in very, very close to your house.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because actually we have our feeder closer to the kitchen window because we want to look out, and we were hoping that we'd see the birds close up and then we'd be trying to figure out what type of bird that is. And then we played around with it a little bit. We hung it on the goalpost, but then we were worried that a bird might get caught in the net, so we took it off there. Then we brought it further down to where we have monkey bars. And again, then we thought, well, if they're at the feeder, we're not going to be able to see them because we've got quite a nice long garden. So then we brought it back up close again. So that's an interesting thing, that we need to gain the bird's trust so that they know it's a safe place to come.
Another great idea for a small garden, I know this is going to sound crazy, you know, the old fashioned clothesline where you have a rope going across the garden from post to post. Years ago, like the clothesline was the most important thing in the back garden, like there'd be clothes pegs and you'd get a clip around the ear if it rained and you were meant to bring in the clothes. But a clothesline is a great idea for bird feeders. Hang your bird feeders on a clothesline. It gives them a little bit of space where they can actually see any danger that might be around. And also it gives them, they're away from a fence, for example, where a cat might be or a predator could be. So a clothesline, if anybody has a clothesline, you may not use it in the wintertime, but a clothesline is a great idea for hanging feeders. And don't forget also, you need to put out food on the ground. Your magpies will come in and take the large piece of food. But some of the small birds, like chaffinches, they are not used to hanging from a bird feeder. So some seed on the ground is a very important thing to do. Not too much, because you don't want to attract rodents, but enough for the birds to get through each day.
And how important is it then to put out water for the birds as well?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that, Jenny, because that is so, so important, particularly in really cold weather that we have at the moment. Water is vital, not just for the birds to drink, but if you can imagine, all the birds that are in your garden are at this moment tucked up in a bush or in a hedge, and they're fluffed up and they fluff up their feathers to keep them warm. And it's a tough time. Their feathers need to be in immaculate condition to keep them warm. They are the electric blankets of the bird world. That is what allows a bird to survive cold nights. So they need to bathe as much as they need to drink. They need to make sure their feathers are in absolutely prime condition. Because if their feathers get worn or get raggedy or get dirty, they won't be able to survive each night. Their feathers lose that insulation. So water is absolutely vital to allow the birds to keep their insulation in full prime condition. Without that, those birds would be in big trouble. They need to be able to survive each night with those feathers, and those feathers need to be clean, pristine and washed. It's really vital. So warm water, if it's iced over, put some warm water out. It really is well worth doing. And I will also say that, like, you can sometimes get quite exotic little birds into your garden. For example, cut apples in half, stick them on branches, see what comes in. There's a good chance that you might even get a black cap coming into your garden. And black caps are little warblers. They're grey birds, and the males have basically, as their name suggests, a lovely little black cap on their head. The females have a lovely chestnut head. And these are little warblers that are in urban areas. I'm in Wicklow. I don't get them coming into my garden in winter. But when I lived in Dublin, I had four or five of these black caps. So cut your apple in half, stick it on a branch, and the chances are you will get black caps.
Thank you very much, Eric. I can't believe you know so much about birds. That's fantastic. Like, it's brilliant. I literally, everything you were saying, I was writing it down. That's brilliant.
There's a couple of books you can get, like Birdwatching in Ireland with Eric Dempsey, and you can get one or two of my field guides. So I'll try and arrange to get some books to you.
And Eric, I must tell you while I have you on the line, I was telling my kids about that I was going to be chatting to you. And actually, you were in my kids' school a couple of years ago there in Holy Cross in Dundrum. And my daughter said she remembered you coming in and talking about birds. That would have been about 2 years ago. It's brilliant that you're going around the schools and you're encouraging this love with the kids. And my daughter remembered, she's 9. So I thought that was pretty cool.
I'm known as the board man in the schools, like board, B-U-R-D. That's in Dublin, the board man.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool that there was a connection there, you know.
Thank you very much indeed, Jenny and Eric Dempsey. Now, you've heard the story, I'm sure, of Goldilocks and the Three Bears. But have you heard the story of Caoimhe and the Red Fox? Terry Flanagan has more on this for us. Terry.
Yes, Derek. Well, we've a very unusual story this week. Recently, we received an email from Aoife Holland, who lives in County Clare. Aoife and her daughter Caoimhe arrived home one afternoon to find a fox in the house. Not just in the house, but on Caoimhe's bed, and fast asleep at that.
So we had an unusual visitor on a wet, dreary Monday evening a few weeks ago. We had just come home from school, and my 12-year-old daughter Caoimhe went into the bedroom to change her clothes. And when she got into the bedroom, she saw a fox curled up on her duvet on her bed. He initially looked up and had a look at her, and then turned his head back and curled back up again and went to sleep again. She obviously got a shock when she saw a fox in her bed. She had a good look before she came out to find me, and I was outside in the garden with her grandfather, and she told the two of us that there's a fox on my bed. We were obviously shocked as well, and we said, no, it can't be a fox. It's probably a blanket or a teddy or something else. Go in and have a look again. And she went in again, and she came out a second time. She said, absolutely, it's a fox. It's on my bed. It looked at me. It's alive. It's there. We obviously went in to have a look at that point, and sure enough, there on the bed was a fox which seemed to be curled up and asleep. And at that point, my father said, you know, we need to try and get it out, and, you know, everybody to kind of stand back. So we kind of all went out of the room and stood back a bit, and he had one of those long umbrellas, and he went in with the umbrella and sort of gently poked the fox from one side to see, was it okay? He wasn't sure if he was injured or if he was unwell, or, you know, it was obviously quite unusual to see a fox inside in a house and on a bed and so calm when so many people were around him. He poked him gently with the umbrella, and he turned and he kind of snarled at the top of the umbrella. So we knew that he was feisty and alive and well. And then he wasn't going moving, though. He turned back around and curled up asleep again and put his tail around his head. And so my dad continued to poke him, and eventually he got off the bed, quite annoyed, I'd imagine, that he was being disturbed from his sleep, and got down and went in under a bunk bed that's also in the room. And he stayed in there for a while. My dad tried to encourage him and coax him out by, you know, with the umbrella, trying to get around the back of him to try and show him the way out. And he didn't want to come out. He was quite comfortable there. And eventually, after some time, he came out, and there was a full-length mirror in the room also. And he had a look in the full-length mirror, sort of admired himself, I suppose, wondered who the other fox was, and went back under the bunk again. And this went on maybe for about 5 minutes. And eventually, I guess he thought a fox wasn't going to get any sleep in this house that afternoon. And he strolled out of the bedroom and out the back door. You know, he wasn't a bit fazed by us looking at him. And he just casually strolled out the door and down the hill and took a left turn and up the road. And we haven't seen the fox since.
I'm not sure I'd like to come home and find a fox in my bed, but there are plenty of foxes about at the moment. I've seen many of them.
Yeah, it's a particularly good time to see them in winter. And also when you see them, they look beautiful because their coat is at its thickest. And of course, at this time of the year, when you're tucked up in your bed, you can hear those cries that are the love calls of foxes, telling us that the mating season has arrived. Now, the males, they produce a bark when they're searching out the female. And the blood-curdling screams you hear, they're produced by the vixen. And if you're lucky, you may actually see a pair tail to tail in the tie position. But anyway, back to our fox. As I said at the start, Aoife was with her daughter Caoimhe when she came across her intruder. And if Aoife was surprised, it was nothing to what Caoimhe experienced.
I was very frightened. I didn't know if it was a teddy and whether they were trying to scare me or something. But I jumped back and ran out the door, and I got Mummy and Granddad and told them, and I was confused myself, didn't know what I just saw, I didn't know whether it was a teddy or whether it was a real fox.
Do you know what the Irish name for a fox is?
No.
It's Madra Rua, and Madra Rua is red dog. So did he look like a red dog?
Yes, his fur was amazing. It was like really dark red and brown, and his ears were like slightly black, and he had some brown on him as well.
Would you like him to come back again?
Well, I really love animals, and maybe not sleep, but I definitely like to be near him again. I was just wondering, would he bite me if I petted him?
Well, he is a wild animal, and I would say to you, don't pet him. I would not try and pet any wild animal. I would keep your distance. They don't want to attack you, but if they feel startled, they may attack. So please don't try and pet him.
have they any predators in Ireland now?
No, except man. I suppose that would be the biggest predator they have. There are no large predators in Ireland, but they might be hit by cars, or sometimes they may carry disease like the mange and they can die from that. But no, they don't have any predators.
If he comes up again and looks hungry, should we feed him?
Well, that's a really good question, because some people like to feed foxes and others are against it. They are wild animals, and the one thing you don't want to do is make the fox dependent on you for food. So if you're feeding a fox all of the time into the heavy winter, the really hard winter, and then you stop it for some reason or other, and then he has to go look for food elsewhere and he may not be sure where to get it. Also, you have to take into consideration your neighbours, because when you live in the country, your neighbour may be a farmer. So you may want to feed the fox in your garden, but the farmer who lives next door to you, he may not want you feeding it. So it's really something you have to sit down with your mum and dad and talk about. Should you feed foxes? If you are going to feed them, probably the best thing to put out is dog food. So if you put out some dog food and a bowl of water, they'll love that.
Okay.
Well, listen, that's great. Thanks a million for sharing your story with us. It's certainly very unusual.
No problem. We're only delighted to send it on.
Thank you, Aoife, and thank you, Caoimhe.
Thank you, Terry. Bye.
Bye.
What a lovely story. Thank you very much indeed to Caoimhe and her mum, Aoife, and to Terry Flanagan for bringing it to us. Now, what better way to embrace the incoming spring and brush off those wintry pandemic blues than the fun and buzz of learning to become a beekeeper? Every February, the Dublin Beekeepers Association take on 65 beginners, teaching them everything from hives and equipment to swarming and harvesting honey and lots more in between. This year, they'll be teaching the course online for the first time, but they'll also be offering practical hands-on classes and demonstrations later in the season. Earlier, I spoke with Kieran Harnett, Public Relations Officer for the Dublin Beekeepers Association, and when we chatted, he was in the hen house in his back garden.
Hi chickens, how you doing? So I've got about 25 hives in the back garden here as well, which I can see from the back of the house, which is fantastic because you can watch the bees even without going outside and getting wet. I've got some chickens here too that like to keep me company whenever I hang around the garden.
Tell me about the Dublin Beekeepers Association.
Yeah, sure thing. So the Dublin Beekeepers Association has been running since about 1943, one of the biggest beekeepers associations in the country, and it's very active. We hold monthly meetings every month, and it's very social. It's one of the nice things about being a beekeeper is that you get to meet up and chat about all the other beekeepers all the time. Every year we do a training course to try and recruit new members and just to teach people who are interested in learning about bees and beekeeping. And, you know, they can come along to our meetings and learn the craft, and eventually, hopefully, some of them will go on and become beekeepers.
I must say, Kieran, your bees don't sound like bees at the moment. They sound like robins and chickens.
That's right, yeah. I've also got a few chickens going on here in the back garden and a wealth of bird life, which is great. So it's one of the things about beekeepers is that you become very aware of the natural world, and that leads on to things like looking after the birds and the other animals around, you know.
Now, you say that one of the defining characteristics of beekeepers is that they love to talk about their love of the bees, which fits in very well with education. And that's something we learned from the late Philip McCabe when he was on this programme. He really did love to talk about bees and all things bees.
Yeah, he was a great man to talk, Philip. I knew him well. He was fantastic, and he was a great advocate and a voice for the beekeepers of Ireland. So he sadly missed, unfortunately.
So tell me a little bit about the training course. What can I expect if I'm to sign up?
Well, it's a series of lectures that this year we've had to go online to keep up with the times. Normally there would have been live lectures in our meeting place in Wesley Hall in Dublin. But this year we're going to hold them over Zoom meetings, and it's 8 lectures held over 8 weeks, and they're on Tuesday evenings. And it's go-to meetings is the format we're using. And then hopefully, if the restrictions ease a little bit, we'll be able to do live demonstrations in our association apiary in Dublin in Rathfarnham, where people can come along and get a bee suit on and get some experience handling bees and opening up beehives.
And what kind of topics are you going to cover? He's strangling that chicken, by the way.
No, they're very chatty. They're so friendly here. They're like, they're pets, you know. We're going to cover everything that is involved in becoming a beekeeper, from a general introduction to the types of bees in the hive, to controlling swarming, where to place your beehives, how to get a start in beekeeping, the importance of bees to the environment in general, and a bit about other types of pollinators such as the bumblebees and hoverflies and things as well. And then we'll have question and answer sessions and some more practical sessions about how to build beehives and hive parts as well.
Fantastic. And of course, the end result is going to be honey. And I'm imagining that there's a growing awareness of the importance of locally produced honey. I remember Philip telling me on more than one occasion, more honey was being sold in the world than was actually being produced.
Yeah, it's a bit of a controversial subject. Quite a lot of the very intensively produced commercial honeys can have issues with them being adulterated with sugar syrups.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys that are doing the adulterating are very cute. They're coming up with constant innovations to try and hide what they're doing. And then the guys who are testing the honey to check for fraud are also trying to keep up with them. It's like an arms race. So the best way to ensure that you're going to get pure raw honey from a reliable source is to go to your local beekeeper or go to a shop selling honey from your local beekeeper, and you know exactly what you're getting then.
Now, honeybees, like all our pollinators and the wider environment, are under increasing pressure from habitat loss, global warming and pesticide use.
Yeah, it's increasingly an issue, and like we've had bans recently on certain types of pesticides, so there's a little bit of state of flux at the moment where farmers and land users are changing the types of pesticides that they're using, and we hope that they don't go back to using even more harmful older pesticides, because currently the neonicotinoids, which are the ones that are currently being used, are being phased out across Europe. So it's one of the things, I suppose, you learn when you learn about bees is you become increasingly aware of the impact of chemical use and spraying on the wider environment, you know, and it's all going into our food as well.
Mm.
I've kind of gone down the road of trying to eat organic food and growing my own organic fruit and vegetables and herbs if I can, just because I've become more aware of, you know, what's going into the food we eat.
I was going to say, given the current lockdown we're experiencing and the previous two, this is our third, and God knows how many there'll be before it's all over, beekeeping would be an interesting activity to have in the garden. And then in my mind I said, well, you don't do very much as a beekeeper, or do you?
Well, there's a few schools of thought on that, and there's as many types of beekeeping as there are beekeepers.
Indeed.
But really, we're beekeepers, not bee havers. And, you know, that's what we try and teach in the Dublin Beekeepers Association, is that you could put a beehive in the end of your garden and you might or might not have any bees in it in 3 years' time if you don't look after them. In particular, there's a few novel parasites that the bees get. And if you don't treat the bees for the parasites, then they can succumb after a couple of years. And also they can suffer from things like bad weather and starvation and lack of food, same as all other animals.
So what do you do?
Well, you have to kind of, we inspect the beehives every week, usually in the summertime, and we just check that they're not making preparations to swarm, which is how the bees reproduce on a colony level, where the old queen and half the bees can fly off across the hedges, leaving the hive to make new queens in their place. And if that happens, you've lost your honey crop and half your bees, so, and also you may have annoyed your neighbours, so it's not ideal. So by checking your hives every week, you can interrupt that swarming process and control it a little bit, and you can make sure that you get a honey crop and also that you don't become a nuisance to the people around you.
Indeed. Just before we let you go, Kieran, can you tell me, it's open to everybody, I assume, you don't have to be from Dublin to take part in this online course, do you?
No, absolutely. We welcome everybody who has an interest in learning about the bees. And one of the nice things about the online course is that the numbers aren't restricted. So you can have family members, you can have children and parents sitting together and learning together about the bees, rather than just one member of the family attending in a lecture.
Well, it starts in February and all the details are on our website, which is rte.ie/Mooney. Kieran, thank you very much indeed. I'll let you get back to your chickens.
Great. Thank you very much for having me on, Derek.
Bye. Isn't that just a heartwarming sound? Come on, does that make you kind of just feel okay about yourself? That's all we have time for today. My thanks to Aidan Ilana, Richard Collins, Dr. Matthew Jebb from the Botanic Gardens, our researcher John Riley, and our broadcast coordinator, Jarlath Holland. Don't forget, if you want to take part in our photographic competition, all you got to do is visit the website for the details, rte.ie/Mooney. Until next week, bye!
Look deep into nature, said Albert Einstein, and you will understand everything better. And where better to celebrate our natural world than in the art of nature photography? Calling all budding photographers and nature lovers alike. Join us for the first Eye on Nature wildlife photography competition. To enter, see rte.ie/eyeonnature. For updates, watch The Today Show on RTE One and tune in to Mooney Goes Wild on RTE Radio One. Eye on Nature, presented by RTE with the National Botanic Gardens Dublin and the Office of Public Works. RTE Eye on Nature. See the world.
Mooney Goes Wild was presented and produced by Derek Mooney.